This is the first of two parts of a story I wrote sometime in 2006 called The Last Race. It was the summer of 1966, and as usual around that time of year, the buzz around the West Demerara region was the annual school track and field meetings. Sonny Ramsuk School was participating in the Lower Demerara sectional finals taking place at the newly renovated community center grounds, and he came early that morning to the pavilion to secure a good seat. But once again, he took his seat as a reluctant spectator, evidently disappointed not to be among the competitors, as he had practiced hard for the past 2 months on a makeshift sandpit behind his house. He had failed to qualify for all three of his pet events, the high jump, long jump, and the 400 meters relay race. Strangely, he was not bitter about his continuing failures in track and field events. He had come to accept that the black kids were physically superior and athletically better. Having grown up in a village among black people, he was quite aware of his physical limitations in relation to speed and agility, and though he never surrendered his ambition to be a track star, he knew it was an uphill battle to beat the black kids in a foot race. Even the black girls like Desiree Gibson outran him with ease. So from the vantage of his personal experience, he knew that running against black kids was like a mule trying to outrace a horse, and with that reality he was gradually resigning himself to the fact that he would never become a track star. It was slightly overcast that morning, with the usual forecast calling for scattered showers, but with the strong northeast trade winds pushing the dark clouds south to the Soosdyke area, it promised to be a glorious day for everyone on the coast. Sonny took advantage of his early arrival time to scout out the seat with a clear view of the track and the presentation area, and then hooked his food satchel onto the security railing. He sat there, alone, but not for long. A bevy of pretty girls, whom at first he did not recognize, as they traded their school uniforms for fancy dresses, settled themselves into the seats just two rows ahead of him. Among them was Savitri Puran, a pretty petite girl from his class, who, for some unknown reason, was not one of the girls that the boys talked about. Nevertheless, he was infatuated with her, and from the way she would smile at him in school, he was sure she felt the same way about him. But he was always too embarrassed to make her acquaintance, perhaps so because he was afraid of the consequences. For if he simply passed a pencil to her or picked up her exercise book, he was sure to hear a chorus of oohs and ahs from the girls and endless teasing from the boys. That morning when she looked at him and smiled before taking her seat, he purposed to go up to her and make small talk during the lunch interval. In the meanwhile, his eyes settled upon the large wooden table placed in the center of the ground, and which was stacked head high with assorted prizes. Among the unwrapped gifts he could see school supplies, pens, pencils, rulers, notebooks, novels, book bags, ribbons, and there, towering from the center of the table, was the silver-plated trophy to be awarded to the champion of the last race. As the morning progressed, the athletes took to the field for warm-ups. The black kids did some stretching exercises. Some practiced jumping out of the blocks, and a few kept hopping around as they slapped their hamstrings into shape. On the other hand, Ramsamy Gurwa and a small contingent of East Indian competitors leaned against the chain link fencing and observed the black kids with the indifference of those who saw no need for such preliminaries. That prompted Sonny to contemplate the reason for a poor showing of Indians at track and field events. Indians were not known for athletic prowess in the track and field arena. There were no Indians of track and field renown that he could recall. Not in the Olympics, not in Commonwealth Games, not even in less prestigious events. And with over a billion Indians, he expected at least there would have been a few exceptions to the rule. But still, he could not think of any. The athletes that did make the Indian Olympic contingent were either wrestlers or boxers, and neither of these sports required track skills. But even then, it came as no surprise to the international sporting community when all the Indian boxers hit the canvas in the preliminary bouts. The wrestlers fared a little better in their matches, and Sonny derived his own explanation. Wrestling required very little running, and mostly lying down on a mat and trying to execute a yoga-type hold on the opponent's stomach. And Indians could hold that position forever, as they contemplated the karmic impact of their actions in the next life. So Sonny reasoned that it must have something to do with genetics. Maybe Indian genes were walking or strolling genes. Then he began to reminisce on the possible impact of the Indian philosophy of pacifism and nonviolence on their athletic aspirations. Was it possible that the turn-the-other-cheek mentality was having a subliminal impact on the competitive spirit? Could it be that the contemplative nature of Eastern mysticism led them into a quietism of mind and body so antithetical to the spirit of competition? Or could the apathy arise simply from the continuous mental bombardment with the idea that sports cannot provide a living and should not be the prime objective of one's endeavors? At least that is what his father always told him when he said he wanted to be an athlete. "Boy, you put your head down and study hard to become a doctor, lawyer, or engineer. And after that, you could take up some sport as a hobby." Just then, his eyes caught the red and blue striped cricket sweater donned by a middle-aged man seated two rows ahead of him, and immediately his mind flashed the recent dominance of the Indians in international cricket. He mused on the fact that Indians have had much success in cricket and other events like squash and field hockey, and since speed was not a major criteria for any of those events, there was not enough credible evidence to support the notion that the philosophical orientation of Indians was to be blamed for their lack of success in track and field. He then lowered his sights to himself, where for the past half hour he had been sitting like a sadhu with legs plaited under him on the hard green heart pavilion steps, and instantly his mind drifted to the gods of Indian lore so lavishly pasted over the walls in his mother's sacred corner of the house. For a while, he thought about the yogic posture that came so easy to him, and he wondered if it had a negative impact on the muscles and joints so critical for acceleration and speed. When Sonny ran against black kids, he was aware of how fluid and coordinated they were in contrast to his languid and off-keel motion. It was like their legs and joints were oiled with 10W-30 motor oil, whereas the Indians seemed like they needed a few sprays of WD-40 on the hip, knee, and ankle before each race. When the Indians ran, they looked like straw men being blown in the wind, arms flailing and legs moving like they were tied together with heavy gauge elastic bands. Maybe it was a structural deficiency, he reasoned, but what could he do about it? Yoga, meditation, pacifism, the innate desire to squat on any available piece of open ground or park bench, were all intricately connected to their cultural and philosophical heritage, and, such being the case, he reasoned, there was little hope for athletic improvement. The cool mid-morning breeze tossed candy wrappers and odd bits of newspaper into the air as the rising sun began to peep through the dense foliage of a huge mango tree that ironically was made famous for its lack of fruit production. Local experts explained the phenomenon simply as a man tree. Any fruit tree that did not produce fruit was simply a man tree. Of course, the local self-appointed agronomist never explained why this man tree produced buds and the occasional mango. Nevertheless, the tree appeared healthy and its huge branches provided bountiful shade to idle old people looking for somewhere to squat and regurgitate the same old stories. Sonny unplatted his legs as though hoping to correct the structural problem for his posterity. An hour had not passed since he ate his tennis roll and already his stomach was growling again like a rice-eater dog. Then it occurred to him that just maybe the athletic malaise of his race might be related to their unique dietary intake. His mother, for one, had often tried to alleviate the frustration of our son's runner-up finishes by explaining that black people gave their children a cup of Carrilla Bitters for tea every morning, while East Indians drank red rose tea like the white people. The bitters, she said, purify the blood and cleanse the pores. Besides, she added, black people ate a lot of beef, plantain, and ground provision, whereas Indians consume lots of garden vegetables and cow's milk. That's Bucky. A black kid with a bloated belly and bung navel from the neighborhood would chant, plantain and duff make black man tough, rice and dal make coolie man tall. Sonny worried about the truth of that claim, as Indians were on average no taller than black kids, skinnier, but not taller or shorter. So, the supposedly advantageous effects of their special diet were questionable. Nevertheless, the beef part had Sonny really worried, because he was a Hindu, and Hindus did not eat beef. The cow was sacred to them, and was not to be slaughtered, even if famine plagued the land. His sister Padmini once tried a sampling of curry beef at a Muslim friend's house, but was betrayed next morning when she broke out in boils from head to toe, so terrible it looked like she was in Egypt and Moses cursed the land. Of course, Sonny's mother explained that the boils were from Brahman, who was angry at Padmini for dietary apostasy, and as expected, Padmini never again touched anything associated with the word beef. Sonny finally resigned to the faith that it was the way things were, and it was not likely to change in the foreseeable future. Every race was blessed with some unique talent. As he saw it, the Indians would continue to produce doctors and lawyers and engineers. The engineers will build the track and field stadiums. The doctors will mend the disabled athletes. And the lawyers would sue them both for malpractice.